Unaccustomed as I am to public speaking, this is the MyMac.com Podcast 121.
It's time for a geekgasm.
The next generation of radio, it's the MyMac.com Podcast.
Alrighty.
And it is My Mac Podcast 121. The intro this week by Larry Grinnell. Hey, Larry.
Hey there. Hi there. Ho there.
I'm joined in the studio here with Chad Perry.
And on the other end of our Skype line, we've got, of course, Guy Searle. Hello, Mr. Searle.
Oh, hello, hello. I think this is the first time that both Larry and I have gotten together in this way.
And I am, of course, Tim Robertson, and hey, let's talk about Macs and stuff.
Why not? Man.
Macs. Okay. Macs are cool.
If we got nothing else to do.
You know, I thought I came up with a cool slogan, Geekgasm, and then, of course, we checked it, and someone already has geekgasm.com.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That's just my luck. Damn it.
A little slow to the punch.
So did you guys get to listen to the last week's podcast, Larry and Guy?
I sure did, and I can't hear Guy.
Yeah, no. You can't hear me at all?
You can't hear Guy?
No, sir.
Well, you're not missing much, really.
Yeah, well,
true.
I've heard him for 40 years, so.
Let's, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to stop the Skype call with you guys and restart it.
Okay.
They think we're going to restart it, Chad. I don't know.
Nah, I'll leave them hanging.
Domino's pizza.
You know.
We can, yeah.
Well, we can wing it.
And I'm here.
Okay. Guy's back.
Hello, Larry.
And, yep.
Can you hear Guy now? Okay, good. We're good to go. Nothing like technical difficulties while you're recording the podcast. Anything.
You bet.
Nah, just keep it rolling. Let, you know, Mac users are accustomed to having to...
MyMac.com podcast, no editing required.
No
the
editing.
Shows that we're all human.
Let everybody hear what the show's really like. Backstage pass. So we were supposed to do an interview with another Larry tonight.
Yeah.
But Larry O'Connor from Otherworld Computing, they didn't respond to us. They were supposed to come on tonight. And
haven't heard boo.
We haven't heard anything, so the show must go on, right?
Indeed.
So we got the next
well,
last thing.
Most companies don't like advertising.
Our Larry. Yeah, I know. You know, he'd have to get on the show and actually, you know, talk about his products and sell a couple of thousand more from a great appearance on the show.
And accept our gratitude for
giving
prizes. I mean,
yeah.
they sent us nice.
All kidding aside, Mac Sales really hooked us up with, in Otherworld Computing, I should say, really hooked us up with prizes for the Apple podcast, Apple Store podcast.
Yep.
And I will say about when it comes to Otherworld Computing, I got the PR today via email. They are now selling a external and internal
really?
Blu-ray burner
Ooh.
For the Mac.
Wow.
Yep, $599 for the internal and right around $650 for the external. Hooks up via FireWire or
about 50
USB 2.
Mm.
So,
wow.
It is, yeah, they burn the 50 gig discs. Now, that's not a cheap, and the media are not cheap at this moment. I mean, they're quite expensive.
Yeah.
But man, that's 50 gigabytes. That's a lot of.
Well, now that you can do your own
hard
backup with.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
No,
I
didn't get that much information,
2X.
To be honest. The first ones are usually around 2X. I mean, I've got one of the companies that I freelance for. They have a DVD burner in there, and it's only a 2X. And I'm like, oh, God, this thing is so slow. So when I have to send something on DVD and I have to burn it, and it's like 3 gigs, I'm like,
see you tomorrow.
Oh, crap, that's about 20 minutes that I got to sit
Good
here
night,
and wait.
Good night, everybody!
Yeah. Well, I'm so used to it, so much faster. Yeah, and come back tomorrow, and it's verifying. Oy. But, yeah, you know. Jumping up here, I know I saw someone had it. I don't see the link. I think I saw it also on the Mac Observer. Yep, OWC launches Blu-ray drives for Mac, burns up to 50 gigs of data or high-definition video per Blu-ray disc, or up to 8.5 using standard DVD, so you can burn a standard DVD with it. True plug and play, supports FireWire and USB 2.0, and it says USB 1.1 compatible. Yeah, right. Well, you're going to send 50 gigs over a USB 1.1 port.
And they're throwing in 225 gig Blu-ray media discs. So. Yeah.
And it's available with the full retail version of Toast 8, so that's always cool. I'm wondering when iDVD will become compatible with Blu-ray. So you can literally take your, you know, a lot of people now are starting to buy those high-definition camcorders. Now you can edit it in iMovie. You can do whatever in iDVD with it. And now you can literally put it on a high-definition disc, Blu-ray.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this kind of signals the the dominance of Blu-ray and not HDVD?
All you heard for a long time was HD. And isn't Apple on the Blu-ray board?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, they are. Whereas Microsoft is basically on the HD board. And I don't know. I think that HD DVD is simply a better name. It's much more descriptive of what it is.
Right.
I mean, what the hell is Blu-ray? I mean, that's a generic, boring name. You know, I thought it was going to be an internal Sony designation of what the product was about.
I thought it was the next
come out with
and then it is
marketing.
Blu-ray. Yeah. Blu-ray.
Well, technically, it's what they use to disable Aquaman, so the Blu-ray.
Don't go there.
So, yeah, geekgasm. But
family entertainment.
Family entertainment. I think this really signals that Blu-ray is going to be a contender. In fact, I would say it gives, not just because the Mac is supporting it, blah, 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 but because there are a lot of third-party support for the Blu-ray drives at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, now
50
they're
gigs,
finally,
man.
They're finally
I
starting
could go for
to get some
50 gigs.
As well,
oh, yeah.
And you're starting to come down in price already.
Yes.
Well, of course you do, Tim.
Well, I've got a player.
Does Toshiba have a burner yet for HD-DVD?
You know, I haven't really been tracking HD DVD burners that much.
No,
I don't remember seeing
one.
That doesn't mean they don't exist. Well, let me Google it real quick. HD DVD burner. And the Google says,
come back later.
You know, it's funny. Yeah, it's yeah. It says product search results for HD DVD burner, and it's all to Blu-ray. It is.
Don't
new Pioneer Blu-ray disc.
Google is on Apple.
No, that's not what I was looking for, Google.
Well, it reminds.
Toshiba does have an HD media streamer, HD DVD burner.
Yep.
So, yeah, they are out there, and it has a 1 terabyte disc in it, which is probably just 2 500s rated.
That's kind of expensive.
So, yeah, they're out there, but that's not for, oh, yeah, that's, you know, $800-$900. But that's right. Not in a computer. That's for a home entertainment system, so you can literally
I'm
record your HD
when
content.
I can get one of those mm-hmm. burners for my iBook G4.
Interesting. Yeah, definitely. I'm sure we'll be just jamming on that.
I hope you got a spare battery.
Apple released a update this week, a pretty important one, 10.4.9, which means we got to be pretty close to 10.5 because
you can't go much further than this.
Are we going to get
10.4.9 and
part 2?
11 and 12 and...
Yeah, there
you
go.
Ice cream
yeah, that's
here.
True. They could do that. I wouldn't put it past them. Geekgasm.
Well, has anyone used it yet?
So, you know, I was going to talk about that. I'll let you guys go first.
Anybody
else tried it yet?
I know that the 933 iBook G4 had no problems with it. Loaded right up, shut down with no problems, loaded up, no problems. Then I did it on my kid's iMac G5, And I walked away from the machine because I was coming downstairs to work to the Intel iMac to get that set up. And my wife called down going, oh, this machine is going berserk. So I went back upstairs, and the fan on it was you know, sounding almost like a B-17. It was so loud. No, it didn't crash. You know, it was just
it crashed then.
With the fan going bananas. So I actually had to reach around to the back and just do a hard shut off and started it back up.
Yeah, that's called a crash, well, guy.
Technically.
That's pretty much the definition of a crash, when the computer won't respond and you have to unplug it and plug it back in and the fans are going, that's a crash.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
It didn't crash. It was just unresponsive. It was more like a swerve. It was like I hit a pothole. It wasn't technically a crash, officer. I was completely in charge the whole time.
It's not the blue screen of death. It's the blue screen of ambivalence. It'll be back in a minute.
Well, it was more of a greenish aqua.
It came more of a greenish aqua. Can we stop making fun?
I wouldn't call it a blue screen. Okay, so his iMac crashed.
We're going to start this again.
Your update. Okay,
It crashed.
Theoretically, it didn't really crash, though, Tim.
Turn it back on. Took a little while to boot back up, but it was fine. And didn't have any problems with the Intel iMac. As a matter of fact, once it finished its boot up, and, you know, I haven't run any benchmarks on it or anything, but it seems a little snappier.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. When I updated, I didn't see much difference on the G5 tower. That machine's pretty snappy anyways. But on the power, or on the, see, I almost said PowerBook. Ooh, MacBook Pro, one of the problems that I've had, no, it didn't. It actually went really smooth and restarted, and I didn't notice any difference, but I thought, well, maybe it does feel a little snappier.
You just wanted it to be snappy.
Might just be my imagination.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
But here's the thing that, yeah, tell me about it. One of the things that had happened with my MacBook Pro is the time that I have left my battery meter up in the menu disappeared. And no matter what I did, I could not get it back, and it was driving me crazy. And that's been like that for like 2 months now. I've pretty much given up that for whatever reason, unless I did a clean install, it's just gone, that battery meter in my menu. And you kind of need that on a laptop.
Yeah.
It just didn't want me to know how much time I had left. It's back now, and it's working fine. So I was like, oh, cool, this update fixed that. But the biggest problem I've had since day one, the first day I've had this MacBook Pro, when I open it up from sleep, even if it was on the same network, the wireless network, it still took 15 seconds before it would see the network,
join it, and then I could do anything online. Back into it?
Literally. So
from sleep?
It said it was logged in. But if you looked up in the menu bar, and it shows you your status.
Yeah.
It was whited out.
Mm-hmm.
And I would sit there and wait for it, and then it would show that it's connected, but then I still had to wait about 10 seconds before it was really connected and I could do anything. And that just drove me crazy, and it did it with every wireless network I've ever joined with that machine. It would see it, but it would take, you know, 10 to 20 seconds to actually get on the network and I could do anything. And it just drove me crazy. And I knew that wasn't normal because my PowerBook G4 never had that problem. Never. And it was...
Yeah.
Well, sure, because it, you know, has to communicate with it and sign on. But this would even with the trusted networks that I already had set up, especially my access point at home, it just took forever to join. So, but I got used to that. It was a major annoyance to me. And I've tried zapping the print. I tried everything over the last year or so to correct that problem. Nothing worked.
No.
I updated this 10.4.9 on it, and now it's immediate. I wake it up from sleep, boom, it joins the network within seconds.
Cool.
And I don't know what they fixed, but whatever they did in 10.4.9, wow, it really made a big difference. And that's a huge thing. That's 20 seconds every time I wake it up from sleep that I'm not just sitting there twiddling my thumbs. And you start adding that up after, you know, just a few months, that's a lot of wasted time waiting for the computer to do something that should be almost instant. So,
well, there's
got to give 10.4.9 thumbs up.
10.4.9 is also causing some other people some problems.
Well, you know, I don't think I've ever heard of I don't care if it's Windows, Linux, Mac, I don't care who did it. every time someone comes out with an update to an OS, it always seems to break something for somebody.
You can't predict every possible combination of DLLs or drivers or whatever else. So.
That's right. Well, that's one of the reasons that Windows users have so many problems that Mac users don't,
right.
Because Microsoft doesn't control the hardware, whereas Apple does control the hardware, so they know
as
the bare minimum that each machine
with,
is definitely going to have. And they can literally have each one of those machines in a testing facility to test their OS on before they release into the wild. There's no way Microsoft could have the different combinations of PCs that are out there that are released every day, not to mention the homebrew computer guys who build their own.
Right.
You know, that's insane. So that's one of the reasons that the Mac really is a better platform. Apple controls the hardware.
Yeah.
I mean, some people say, oh, I want choice in my blah, blah, blah. Well, okay, Linux boy, go play with your little TRS-80 that, you know, that's slave to your IBM 256 gigabyte hard drive that's slave to, I mean, you know, give me a break.
Right.
You want choice, you can have choice, but you don't want... we
Linux
have
fanboys will be coming after you with a vengeance now, Tim. Linux. Oh.
You know, that's not... You know, Linux is truly the choice. I don't want to hear about this, Mac. You guys are just so Apple fanboys.
My old boss,
fanboys.
When I first went into tech publications many years ago, hated Macintoshes. He was an extra-class amateur radio operator and a tinkerer, and I'd hear him go to this thing, Macintoshes. There are no diff switches. There are no batch files. There are no jumpers. How can you call that a computer? So I said, well, Tom, I just sit down, and I'm productive right away. Ah, you're just a Mac bigot.
Well, Larry,
yeah.
You are.
They like to. Somehow they like to. Well, it's easier, so it's not a real computer.
Well, I'm surprised you didn't curse about the lack of vacuum tubes either, bud.
So I was asking earlier, did you guys actually get to listen to Podcast 120? So what did you think about the ending? What I threw in there that Russ Walkowicz sent about
that was really cool.
And then.
Yes, you could.
That was the summer of 1999.
You could hear hints of.
We're still talking 56K.
Podcast visionary.
You know, it wasn't even hints. Yeah. I was talking about, you know, intro music. It would be the content that's on our website. It would be in an MP3 format that people can download, maybe QuickTime format. The only thing I didn't say was podcasting in iTunes. I mean... That's true.
And you'd totally forgotten that you'd ever done that until Russ sent it to you.
When I started the podcast in 2004, I'd completely forgotten 5 years before that I had had that premonition.
I'm a pioneer.
Yeah, so I felt like sending it over to Adam Curry and go, yeah, kiss my ass.
Well, never
from 5 years
Tim,
ago,
just
pal.
Said it.
Who's the real pioneer? Yeah, now I got to put the explicit tag on. Great. Chad and I has actually been talking about starting up a second podcast.
Mm-hmm.
No firm plans yet, but it's something that would be fairly simple to do for us. But it wouldn't be associated with MyMac.com, and it would kind of be...
Pretty much a free-for-all.
A free-for-all with an explicit tag, not for minors, you know, that sort of thing. So, I don't know. It's something that we're looking into. Back on show 119, we had Russ Walkowicz on, and he was talking about the new
Verizon
Fios.
Yeah,
and we got feedback on that. So let me play that feedback here. Hold on.
Hey guys, this is Scott in Tampa, and I'm actually calling about podcast 119. I'm a little behind right now. In the discussions about Verizon Fios, let me preface this with saying that I've been working for Verizon on this project since 2003. And I just wanted to clear one thing up about the Fios TV that was discussed. While Verizon does resell DirecTV in those markets where we don't have Fios TV, they are two different products. Fios TV has their own super head ends, their own satellite dishes, and own diverse fiber ring around the entire country. They are totally two unrelated products. So that beautiful TV quality that you guys are talking about in terms of Fios TV is their, you know, solely on our own. It has nothing to do with any fees from DirecTV. So I do appreciate the kind words on the product and just wanted to clear that up. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Scott. Boy, it kind of scares me that someone from Verizon's actually listening to the show.
Well, it's good to know, though.
That's good to know. But now
it's nice to have feedback, too.
I know, but now I can't say something real negative against Verizon.
Yeah.
Because Verizon's really not around here, so...
This is true.
You know, I see their commercials and stuff, but they're not here in West Michigan, at least in our town.
Well, I can say something negative about Verizon. Why aren't you here kicking Comcast butt?
Because we need some competition in this area, trust me.
Well, it sucks that Russ has it, and you know, I don't live that far away from him, and I don't have that option.
No, I won't say that because you know how long Russ suffered in 56K world before anybody brought high-speed internet access? The poor guy, I tell you, I would talk to him on the phone, and of course, as I said last week, so what's the deal with high-speed in your area, Russ? And this is exasperating.
it's just not there yet.
And then, you know, those other people that had problems, too, in the past. I remember Tad Sheeler. He used to be on the show quite a bit.
Yeah.
It took forever for him to get high-speed. He would check, literally weekly, to see if high-speed was finally at his house. And it was always, like, a quarter mile in one direction, an eighth of a mile in the other.
Slowly creeping its way.
Like, creeping its way to him. And he finally got it, and he was so excited. So, no, I don't begrudge that Russ gets high-speed internet and Guy doesn't, because, Guy, you've already got it. True. But I want higher speed access. I want that fiber.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, fiber.
it's not even so much that. I would just love to get rid of Comcast.
Me too. And if the picture's as good as Russ was saying, I'm looking to get rid of... I'd be more than happy to look at Verizon television.
Competition mm-hmm. is always good.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of people are, oh, I hope Apple wins and... You know, Microsoft goes out of business. No, I don't. Neither I want that competition.
Competition is a good thing.
Absolutely. So, what's going on in the Mac world for you guys? Anything going on? Ooh, silence.
Playing with open source stuff. I've got an interesting thing at work, or at least interesting for geeks. We produce user guides, and we developed a lot of our own fonts. Put in there that simulate things that are on the product screens and the keypads and stuff, and that's great for print, but not so good for HTML.
Hmm.
And so we are looking at many, many different solutions to convert all of our fonts into like JPEG files and figure a way, probably using XSLT or some esoteric thing like that to substitute the font calls for inline graphics, and what a mess.
Yeah,
I never thought I would have caused these problems when I first brought fonts in like 1990. and it solved a big problem. You know, and the writers are trying to put these tiny little graphics in line, and it's so much nicer just to type a character, swipe it over, go to the font menu, and there it is, and looks so nice.
Well, no good deed goes unpunished, Larry.
Yeah, and so now we have like 240 fonts we have to deal with.
Hey, is that a lot, you think?
That's just the product fonts. That isn't the other.
That's just in English.
Do you want to know how many fonts are where I spend most of my time? How many is in their library?
Well, whoever dies with the most fonts wins, you know that.
Yeah, well, about 10,000, so.
Oh, I can believe it.
It's a design firm, so.
Yeah. Yep.
It's also a production studio, so anytime.
Adobe Fontfolio and all those,
yeah,
oh yes.
Yeah, it's everything. It's. I don't know how designers decide which font to use when you have such a huge amount of choice, you know.
Oh, it has to be Garamond.
It's crazy.
Which Garamond?
Yeah,
they're
yeah.
like 20 different Garamonds.
We want to use Arial. Which Arial?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Bitstream, Monotype.
And then you get some design studios that will send stuff in with their designs on it, and they had used their own personal font that they created. So
yep.
It's just like, oy, man, give me a break.
Get on the phone, email it over here, Prado, thank you.
That's exactly right, so...
And they're done that.
Or it gets replaced with Comic Sans or something.
Tom Schmidt, our resident Apple tech guy at MyMac.com, is looking for some problems. Unlike most people that are looking solutions, Tom's looking for problems.
And he's put out a call for help.
Yep, up on the blog site of MyMac.com. And he wants your problems. He wants to share the solutions with the rest of the people that read MyMac.com. So
he feels your pain.
And he has the aspirin to fix it. So that's always a good thing. And somebody else asking for help is Chris Siebold. He has got a book contract to write a book about Mac hacks, which is, that could be pretty cool. I've already told him I'd contribute to it. He asked me quite a while ago, and I said, yeah, I'll help you out. And then I forgot about it. And then he came back and went, hey, you remember that request that I made? And I went, ah, crap. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, sure.
So if you are a aspiring writer and would love to see your name in print, contact Chris Siebold. Just go up to MyMac.com, check on the blog site, and you'll see a post called Call for Help. Or Call for Hacks.
Call for Hacks.
Chris Siebold. And, of course, Bill Palmer, our buddy from iProng, is still posting blogs up at MyMac.com. Over on the feature side, did you guys check out Nemo's top 10-point tutorial? That was great.
On making, like, wedding pictures and stuff?
Yeah, that was fantastic. It's, you know, he is so multi-talented.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And he's got a segment coming up later on the podcast, of course. That's usually how we end it. You know, John's done quite a bit on the podcast now, but I really think that his Book Bites Live, where he interviews the authors, I think
that's
he's really hitting his stride.
He's done.
I think it's some of the best stuff on our podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, those interviews are just, he's right to the point. He lets the people talk without stepping on them, unlike me. And it's just really good stuff. I really enjoy listening. I always look forward to Nemo stuff on the podcast. It's great. Yeah,
almost as good as that Dashboard Minute stuff somebody used to do.
Yeah, I know. You know, he sent in a couple that I used, and I still got another one to use somewhere. I'll figure a place out for it eventually. Did you notice I did post the Apple quiz up at MyMac.com?
Yeah, I took it.
Did you? How'd you do?
I got it like somewhere between 80 and 90. Not too bad.
I actually made that in Keynote, the whole thing. And when Chad,
did you guys use my suggestion about using the remote?
Yes, we did.
Okay, good.
What happened at the podcast last week was Chad and I were at the Apple Store.
Yep.
We had a 23-inch monitor hooked up to his MacBook, and he used his remote control to go through the slides. The battery is about dead in it, so it didn't work as well as it could have or should have. But
it worked well enough on yours.
Yeah. What we didn't realize, I'm surprised it didn't mess any other MacBooks.
I know.
Because they're not tied to one machine. So if you've got two, every time Chad was clicking the button, front row was launching on my machine left and right. It's amazing that...
Yeah, it's all amazing. Over the store, the screens are popping up.
Things are freaking out. You know, it's amazing because we recorded the entire podcast on my MacBook Pro in GarageBand. And, you know, all these different things are happening to it every time Chad's clicking the button. And yeah. We didn't realize it until...
stop.
Well, because Chad's over there pushing the button. I guess it's not working that good. And I'm hearing... Wum, wum, wum. Hey, look. Front row is going crazy on mine. Movie clips are playing left and right. Yeah, so I made the presentation that we showed. And it was just a list of questions and answers. In Keynote, and just in case we didn't have a machine that was going to be capable of running it, I also exported it as an HTML file. So if worst case scenario, I could simply launch a web browser and run the presentation through a web browser. And so we came back from the show and everything was hunky-dory, and I thought, you know, I've got all these HTML files built. I wonder if I could put these online. And sure enough, I did, and that's what we posted, the Apple quiz. So anybody at home could literally, on their Mac, take that Apple quiz, the same one that we were asking at the Apple Store.
Mm-hmm. But you won't win anything.
No, you won't win anything this time.
I crashed and burned.
Did you? The funny thing was, I wrote questions I figured most Apple people would be able to answer. And Chad was like, I don't know, these are kind of hard questions.
And he said, oh, no, anybody knows these. Anybody can answer these questions.
This is simple. Everybody knows what a Pippin is.
Everyone knows Steve Jobs' fourth cousin on his mother's side's name.
I figured most people will know the person that started Apple Computer, one of the original people, with Steve and Steve. I figured everybody would know that.
Yeah.
Steve Squared.
No, everybody kind of looked at it, that slide like...
There was a third guy?
There was somebody else? I was like, wow. But I did tell, you know, after we showed the answer and all that, I said, wouldn't it suck if you were that guy now?
Sold
out. I read that story in one of the Apple Legend books, and he just couldn't do it. He couldn't stay the course, and
well, he was worried about losing his money. He had a family, and he had a house, and you know,
and
they had
$10,000 into it or something.
No, it was like $6,000 to $8,000. It wasn't a whole lot of money, but for him,
for that time, it was.
Yeah, and he really needed
could have been
the money
hundreds of millions.
Well, but you know, hindsight is 20/20.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure the guy's not spending the rest of his life kicking himself in the ass. You do what you got to do to take care of your family. So I don't.
Well, none of that. But you look at you know when Steve Jobs left Apple in 84, 85, he sold all of his stock except for one share.
Yeah.
And lost millions of dollars there as well.
Yeah, I don't think he's hurt now, though. So.
No, I think Steve will be okay.
I think he'll be just fine. So that's going to wrap up the first segment of the My Mac podcast. And I got a couple
things to talk about.
Oh, that's right.
That's right.
Yes, I do. Number one, I wanted to talk about the March 24th, 2007 general meeting for the Washington Apple Pie, which is going to be here in Northern Virginia. At the Luther Jackson Middle School at 3020 Gallows Road, Falls Church. And I hope everyone can make it. It's going to be between 9:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. I'm not sure exactly what time I'm supposed to be on. I'm hoping that that Russ will be able to be out there as well. I with everything else going on in my life at the moment, I've forgotten to get a hold of Russ to give him all the information that he might need.
Well, make sure you post them up on the blog side or send me something, and I'll get it up on the feature side. So
we
need to advertise
this weekend.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it'll be there probably before most people hear the podcast.
Yeah. So go to the MyMac.com website. You'll get all the details. And if you're in that area, you're going to definitely want to check it out.
Yep.
Okay. The other thing I wanted to talk about was I'm in the process right now of using some of the different easy-to-use web page design tools. And I currently have the first of four sites up at macparrot.com.
Sweet.
Made completely with iWeb.
iWeb.
Right.
Right.
Now, of course, it's actually hosted on...
It's hosted.
Stop it. Stop it, you.
Oh, and, I'm sorry. I thought you wanted me to parrot you.
It's actually hosted at .mac, and it's just being redirected over to the actual URL, which is macparrot.com.
That is awesome.
The last thing I want to talk about is my son, Guy. He's had a few health problems as of late, and I won't go all the way into it now. But if you go to macparrot.com, there is a blog there over on the blog side that talks about it. And what I'm looking for are more comments from all over the world. There's 27 there right now, and I want to get it up to about 50 before I show it to him.
So if you guys are listening to this, all seriousness now, we'd really appreciate it if you can go up to macparrot.com. That's Guy's site. And you'll find the link there. And,
yep.
You know. Is it a guest book or?
Yeah. You just hit leave a comment, and it's got a little. You know, you have to have QuickTime in order to be able to see it. So if you're running Windows and you don't have QuickTime on your machine, you won't be able to leave a comment. But I doubt that'll be a problem for most of the people that listen to the show.
So yeah, we'd appreciate it, and you know, make a little guy's day by leaving a comment. If you're not in the United States, even better.
Yep. Leave your name and where you're from, and if you leave a an email address, I will send you a personal thank you.
And then we'll play "We Are the World" and
hold hands,
and everything will be great.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry. I was going to give you an opportunity to do all that earlier, Guy, and my bladder kind of made me forget.
Sure you did.
So, thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And thank you for coming on today, Larry.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Larry.
We're gonna
glad
have,
to do it.
We're going to have Robert Hazelrig join us here in a couple weeks as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
cool.
You know, he's been doing some segments for a long time here on the podcast. Probably, what, 6 months?
Yeah,
and we need to get him on the show and get him live. Mm-hmm. Get him out of his shell. Because he's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
He's insane.
He's crazy, Robert.
So keep your ears peeled. We'll have Bob Happelblap on pretty quick. So
Happelblap.
No, actually, that was Happelblap, wasn't it?
Happelblap.
Yeah.
With a P.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
Silent Q.
So listen to the rest of the show. We got some really cool segments coming up from David Combe. We've got Robert Happelblap's review coming up. And, of course, Book Bites Live with John Nemo. For Chad, Guy, and Larry, I'm Tim. See you next week.
Hello, my name is David Cohen, and I'm the London Bureau Chief for MyMac.com. Welcome to Fenestration, my guide to using a Mac in a Windows world. Welcome to Fenestration 26. Today's topic is going to cover virtualization of Windows Vista, specifically the changes made in the end-user license agreement for Windows Vista when the product was launched a couple of weeks ago. What's happened is that Microsoft has made specific provision in the end-user license agreement for running Vista under a virtual machine under virtualization. This is a technology that Parallels uses on an Intel Mac to enable you to run Windows. It differs from boot camp or from virtual PC in that rather running the Windows operating system natively, as you do under boot camp, or running it under emulation, as you do with virtual PC on a PowerPC Mac, with Parallels you're running it in virtual mode. Virtualization is a process that's built into the Intel processors, and what it allows the processors to do is effectively partition themselves into multiple chunks, and code runs in each of the chunks. So what you do with Parallels, and this is the neat trick that Parallels or VMware Fusion brings to the platform, is it enables this mode and loads the Windows operating system into one of the separate chunks. Now this works really well for Macintosh users because it means you can run Windows and OS X side by side, and there's no risk of actually one system bringing the other down. Microsoft have recognized this technology is new on the scene and have made specific consideration for it in their end-user license agreement. The EULA, or EULA, as it's most commonly referred to, is the set of rules that Microsoft dictates you need to abide by in order to be able to use the operating system. It has nothing to do with actually buying the operating system or the code, but basically it's the agreement you enter into with Microsoft when you run Windows. A prerequisite of installing Windows on any machine, be it PC or Mac, is that you agree to the EULA, normally by clicking a button or ticking a checkbox to say that you've read and agree with all the terms and conditions within. In legal terms, it is a contract, so therefore, having read and accepted those terms and conditions, you imply that you agree with them and are happy to abide by them. The issue with Vista is that, as I said, Microsoft has put specific consideration for virtualization technology into the EULA. What they've said is that if you're running the more basic versions of Windows Vista, that would be Home Basic or Home Premium, you are specifically denied permission to run Windows Vista in a virtual machine with those versions of the operating system. You need to have at least a Business Edition or the Ultimate Edition of Windows Vista in order to get permission from Microsoft to run it in a virtual mode. The issue for Parallels users is that if they want to run Vista, they have to buy one of these more expensive versions, but it goes up to almost double what Home Basic Vista version costs. Now, this is a legal technicality, because the nature of virtualization means that an operating system cannot actually tell that it's running in a virtual session. That's one of the beauties of the system. The virtual machine looks to any code running within it as if it's a complete computer, and there's absolutely no way at all for the operating system to actually push beyond the edges of the virtual machine and detect where it is. Consequently, there's nothing Microsoft can do at present to actually stop you from running, say, Windows Vista Home Basic within a virtual machine. but you have to be aware that if you do this, you are in breach of the EULA. This means that Microsoft is not under any commitment to give you any sort of support, and if you ring up and say that you're running Home Basic in a virtual machine and you want support from them, they will tell you that they can't help you. So this puts a quandary to the Intel Macintosh user who wants to run Vista under Parallels. Do you splash out the extra money for the more advanced version, or do you not? You might say, well fine, I don't think I'm ever going to need support from Microsoft, so I'm happy to run Home Basic within a virtual machine. But the problem is, support can cover more than just telephone calls. It can also cover patches. And patches are something that's very important in the Windows world. The nature of Microsoft's operating systems are they get patched extremely frequently, much more frequently than OS X does, and consequently you need access to those patches. Now you get those normally by downloading them from Microsoft's website. But if Microsoft somehow did become aware that you are running Home Basic under a virtual machine, then they might be able to deny you that support. As I say, it's impossible for Windows Vista itself to detect it's running in a virtual machine. But that doesn't mean that when you connect to the Microsoft website, they wouldn't have some server-side code that might possibly be able to come back to your machine and might surmise that you are running it in a virtual machine and therefore deny you the support that you're looking for and allow you to download the patches. The other thing, of course, is for those of us who like to be 100% compliant with legal practice, is that running Windows Home Basic or Home Premium under a virtual machine and breaching the EULA means that we're not 100% legal. For many people, that's a problem and doesn't make them feel particularly comfortable. So what can you do about this? Well, not an awful lot. Unless Microsoft decides to change its policy, you are compelled to run a more expensive version of Windows Vista if you want to run it on a virtual machine on a Mac, or on a PC for that matter. Another option to consider, and something that I have mentioned on Fenestration before, is whether you want to run Vista at all. What you can do is run Windows XP or Windows 2000, or even something older if it suits you. If it gives you the functionality you need, then it might not be necessary to run the latest version of the Windows operating system. There are no restrictions on virtualization in the older versions of Windows, because at the time the EULAs were written for those versions, virtualization wasn't really a mainstream technology. It was at best something used in server rooms, and consequently the EULAs did not specifically address it. Consequently, there are no specific restrictions about using those versions of the operating system under a virtual machine. Another alternative you may want to consider is looking at buying an OEM version of Windows Vista. An OEM version is a version that is sold with a piece of hardware. And under the terms of the OEM license that Microsoft issued Vista under, if you supply it with a piece of hardware, it can be supplied at a substantial discount. Now, what some suppliers do is they sell Windows Vista with a mouse or a keyboard or something like that. And within the letter of the law, that means that they can supply it at OEM prices. However, I should make clear that the terms of support for OEM versions of Windows Vista are quite limited as well compared to a retail version. While you will still be able to get patches and that sort of thing, you probably won't be able to avail yourself of technical support direct from Microsoft, because the OEM license implies that the vendor of the OEM hardware that sold Windows Vista to you is liable for the first point of call for telephone support. However, if you're clear that you're never going to need online or telephone support from Microsoft, but you just want access to their patching system, then going for OEM version of the software is probably a legitimate and reasonable way to go. That's going to do it for this session. As always, questions or comments to davidcohen@mymac.com. Until the next time.
Hello, Robert Hazelrig here. Today I'd like to talk to you about a couple things. First up is Jella Skins. That's JELASKINS. Jella Skins are skins for your iPod. But they're not just the regular old, normal, clear plastic skins. Oh no, These have some pretty fly, funky designs. Jelliskins are available for video iPods, nanos, minis, and even some older model iPods. So these skins do more than just protect your iPod, but they do protect it very well. They're made of high-quality 3M plastic. But what they do is they transform your iPod into something that's very unique and reflect your sense of style. After sticking the Jelliskin on a few of my iPods, a number of people asked me, what kind of iPod is that? Jelliskins retail for $15. And if you head on over to jelliskins.com, you will literally find dozens and dozens of different designs. Next up, the Laptop Desk version 2 by Lapworks. The Laptop Desk is made out of a rubberized plastic. It is lightweight and portable, and it also folds in half. When the Laptop Desk is fully open and unfolded, it gives me plenty of room to support my G4 iBook and a mouse off to one side. The width of the device would clearly support a larger laptop and a mouse. However, if you had, say, a 17-inch laptop, you would probably want to pick up the mouse pad extender. The mouse pad actually gives you another 4 or 5 inches and snaps onto the laptop desk. The laptop desk also folds to about a 15 or 20 degree angle, which allows you to angle your keyboard up slightly. I find myself using the laptop desk in bed with it at this 20% angle quite often. The laptop desk has a sort of corrugated design where it actually allows the airflow to go underneath your laptop and keep it ventilated and running cool. The laptop desk retails for $30, and you can find it at laptopdesk.net. The last thing up I want to talk to you about is something I just received this week. But I liked it so much, I wanted to talk to you about it right away. The other reason I wanted to talk to you about it right away is because, well, it's going to be getting warmer soon, and then you won't need this type of gadget so often. Have I piqued your interest yet? Well, when I first saw this item, the first thing I said to myself is, why didn't I think of that? It's so simple. Okay, enough dilly-dallying. The item I'm talking about is the Slanket. Yes, you heard me right. It's called a Slanket. It's spelled like blanket, but with an S instead of a B. The Slanket is a big, warm, cozy, comfy blanket, but it also has sleeves. So what this means is, while you're sitting on your couch, typing on your computer, you don't get your arms cold. You can keep them warm in the Slanket. Yes, I know it's not really a gadget, and that tends to be what I review, but this is just such a nifty little thing, handy to have around the house during the cold winter months. The Slanket comes in 5 different colors, and it retails for $49. You can find the Slanket at theslanket.com. Well, that's it for me this week. This has been Robert Hazelrig. Thanks for listening.
About every 3 or 4 weeks, I get an invitation from a publisher to review a book on podcasting, and I always ask our lead podcaster, Tim Robertson, if he thinks it's worth the while. And Tim, in his pithy way, says, "Ah, Nemo, forget about it. I could have written that book myself." Well, there's a book that just dropped on my doorstep called The Podcasting Bible, the book you need to succeed. The authors are Steve Mack and Mitch Radcliffe. The publisher is Wiley, that's W-I-L-E-Y. The cost in the United States is $35, $42 in Canada, and £23 in the United Kingdom. We are delighted to have Mitch Radcliffe, one of the co-authors, on the line here at Book Bites Live on the MyMac.com podcast. Nice to meet you, Mitch.
Well, thanks, John, for having me. Nice to meet you.
This is a collaborative work between Steve Mack and yourself. Who did what Did you work together in the same room, or were you collaborating remotely?
Well, we did meet one time at a Starbucks and have a conversation. No, Steve and I live in the Seattle area, so we worked remotely, but did get together and talk about it. Steve wrote most of the technical chapters on the recording and hosting, and I wrote most of the history chapters and the business chapters in terms of setting up and trying to understand how to make a podcast into a business or use it in business, if that's in fact what you want to do with it.
Well, do you feel that somebody should do what they love and the money will follow, or that podcasting for the serious amateur would be best to be a hobby project?
Well, I think that's a very subjective question. There are a lot of different reasons to do a podcast. But if you're not enjoying doing the podcast, I don't know why you would do it. Why take a job that you hate? For most people, doing it is, it starts as experimentation. It becomes kind of a hobby, but then there are those, you know, who want to actually build an audience and start to make a living or part of their living on podcasting. And that was who we were trying to target with the business portion of this book. The how-to parts in terms of recording and hosting and analyzing how much it might actually cost you to do all of that are written for virtually anybody who comes along and decides that they just want to give this a try, because it is something that's, incredibly accessible. I happen to have been in the webcasting, broadcasting business, 10 years ago, and it was very, very hard and expensive to do. At the very minimum, just to do audio, we had to spend, on the order of $8,000 to $10,000 per system, because we had to buy not only the system and the sound cards and lots of extra storage, which at the time, was far more expensive, but we had to buy Gettner boxes to bring in telephone calls. We had to buy external adapters for the microphones, all sorts of things. And today you can start podcasting for a couple hundred bucks. So
yeah, it's almost on your way home from the Apple store.
Yeah. And I want to avoid sounding like I think you've got to make a podcast into a business, because that's not what I think at all. I think a podcast should be what you want it to be. And because it's so inexpensive, you have the power to make that decision for yourself. But you also, if you're going to turn it into a business, need to look at it from the perspective of costs and potential revenue streams and the ways that you're going to earn that revenue, or that are not going to interfere with the real mission, which is either informing or entertaining people.
But for that reason, should people study the entire book? I mean, this is a serious book. It's 550-odd pages. Should people study this entire thick book before plunging in to some of the complicated procedures and RSS feeds and all the other stuff they need to know under the hood?
No. I think they should start by plunging. They should just go ahead and record some things and then see what they can do with it. There are simple and easy uploading services for audio. Why not just start to work on it? What I would suggest our book is good for is, just like the regular Bible, not that many people, read it from Genesis 1:1 to the end of Revelations. And it's something that they dip into and read different stories and learn about various things. And that's exactly how this is written. So if you get to the point where you've decided that the sound quality isn't right, we can explain to you the various options you have in terms of going out and buying a better microphone, the sonic characteristics of the microphone, what you need in terms of a preamp, if you do need a preamp. There's a lot of stuff that you would not even really know how to use as information until you had done some experimentation. So plunging right in, diving into this very, very deep democratic pool is the best way to start, in my opinion.
Okay, that's a good answer to that. Well, what's your personal podcasting gear and software?
Well, I have mostly Macintosh equipment for my podcasting, because I find that the Mac is a better platform for audio generally. You don't get so many interruptions from background processes, although I've also been doing some experimentation with Vista, and it seems that that's been reduced but not completely eliminated. If you want really, really good audio, I just sort of recommend the Macintosh. And on the Mac, I run Soundtrack Pro, which is Apple's audio editing program, and it is excellent and kind of expensive, but I like it. And I use Skype to record calls. Just like we're doing today. I used to use the combination of Sound Flowerbed and Audio Hijack that you're using to separate the different tracks. But now what I'm doing is using just a Skype call recorder and getting the pieces and generally, you know, doing a premix to make sure I'm getting the right audio levels. In fact, I'm recording too.
That's terrific.
So, you know, that's the easiest way I've found to do audio interviews over the phone. It lets me call a regular phone. I have a M-Audio Fast Track Pro preamp, which is a USB device with a preamp built in, and I'm using an Audio Technica AT4047SV, which is a fairly high-end cardioid mic that I've been using since 1999.
And we can get examples of much of this hardware from the book, Podcasting Bible, Record High Quality Audio and Video from Wiley Publishers. You have quite a few case histories and specific examples of podcasts and podcasts you admire. Can you tell us about some of those case histories and those examples in your book, The Podcasting Bible, please, Mitch Radcliffe?
Well, yeah, we took two different kinds of approaches. One was some shorter examples at the beginning of the book about various podcasts that set the standard. And my favorite podcast from the beginning was the Evil Genius Chronicles.
Evil Genius Chronicles.
Yes, by Dave Slusher. And I like the way he was the first person I heard take this and just make the medium his own. So that's one of my favorites. We talked about the evolution of Adam Curry's daily source code and Dave Reiner's contributions. But then later in the book, we actually did some case studies with individual businesses and podcasts that have been very successful. And some of these, for instance, the Dawn and Drew Show, which is a early couple cast, that is, a married couple that was talking and being online together.
Or better or worse.
Yes, indeed, and awfully funny too. And what we did was, talk to them about what they're using to create their programs. So you get a hands-on view. We also looked at how Microsoft went on the air, so to speak, with Channel 9 and started recording and video casting and walked through the various technologies that they use. So, we wanted to give people an opportunity to try to find something that was analogous to what they may be thinking about doing. So, if you were creative like Dawn and Drew, or if you wanted to do something for marketing like Microsoft, we had a number of different examples. The Ontario Science Center is a museum that's using podcasts to connect with people. So, and we had some help with that too. We had contributors to the book help with that, so that it was really Steve and I benefited from the contributions of others on those.
That's great. Well, that's a good author to know how to use the resources of people who are doing it every day in the real world. Two things about your book that I particularly want to compliment you and Steve Mack on are the terrific history of the emerging podcast technology and podcasting as a social phenomenon, not just a technological phenomenon, and even more important, from the very first pages, a brilliant quick start opening unit so you can make and distribute a podcast right from the first pages of this book. Because the book does get a little bit geeky and quite technical if that's what you want it to do. But if all you want to do is know how to turn on and blast off, you can learn a little bit about the basics of podcasting and get going. So I personally want to congratulate you on that as a book reviewer.
Well, thank you. Steve gets the credit for the quick start. He did a great job with that. And I got to say that all the technical sections of the book, I was very pleased with the kind of information that he delivered, because it does take a tremendous amount of patience to write, as you say, this geeky stuff. And he went into such, you know, interesting details as how to do three-point lighting in order to get a better image and video, too. So, I mean,
Right. You
can get as detailed as you possibly can imagine with this book on the technical side. And I'm glad you appreciate the social history, because that was my work, and I've been involved with this for a long time. And it's good to hear that people appreciate at least my version of the story. I'm sure it's there'll be some contention about what the history is, but
sure,
we'll leave that to history.
Okay, a couple of things, and then we'll wrap it up. You mentioned Audacity, which mm-hmm. is a cross-platform audio editing application. And here at MyMac.com, we use GarageBand and Audio Hijack Pro. Mm-hmm. And Audacity uses something called LAME, or L-A-M-E. Can you just tell us, like in a couple of sentences, what the advantages might be of using Audacity and L-A-M-E, plus or minus GarageBand and Audio Hijack Pro? Where does one succeed where the other might not be as versatile?
I think it's more versatile. You're talking about the options on a Mac, and I think that where Audacity really, you know, shows its strength is on the PC side.
Oh, I get it.
The audio, the format that it produces, is a relatively compact format, which is important in terms of being able to store as much audio as you may want to record.
Sure.
When you're editing a waveform, what you really want to be able to do is get down to the clicks and pops, and you want to be able to find them and remove them. And if you are really conscientious about, you know, taking out people going and ah, which is something that generally broadcasters get over, but none of the rest of us do. You want to just get in there and make a cut and do it quickly. Audacity is a very efficient application for doing that. I prefer the Mac generally. So, I would typically go with, either Soundtrack Pro or GarageBand myself. But when I do use a PC for audio, Audacity is the choice that I've.
Very good. And just to let everybody know who's listening, the Mitch Ratcliffe that you hear is the real deal. We're not going to clean him up any more than we have to. So you're hearing the Nemo and you're hearing the Mitch pretty much as we existed in our live conversation. A couple of final comments. It seems that you need to do your homework, plan and prepare. That is really what comes through this book. Obviously, you can do it a 5-minute quick and dirty podcast, but the planning and preparation are really what make the serious, dedicated podcaster a success.
Well, yeah, I mean, my experience in broadcasting is that the reason people appear informed and entertaining on the air is they prepare to be entertaining and prepared on the air. You can see the example of poorly prepared broadcasters every day on almost any news network, because they're just
Certainly.
Sitting there sort of talking. The thing about podcasting is generally people know their topic really well, and that's why they're talking about it. There's a real passion about it. However, you still have to be aware of what, the listener is looking for specifically from the podcast, what the listener's tolerance for length and, you know, the character of the podcast are, because, I have for many years, I've done an Audible program back in the 90s, would sit down with a script and then sort of free form the script and ad lib throughout the program, but would sometimes ad lib. I tended to swear, and that turned some people off. Now, I made a choice that was, you know, I was okay with that. But there are other, you know, there are other considerations if you're trying to make a business of it that you may, you know, want to, you know, curb your swearing. You may want to avoid shouting or raising your voice. I know when I do the Web Talk podcast with Rob and Dana Greenlee, I tend to, you know, lapse into very odd behavior. And I get very loud, and we've had notes saying, you know, why is Mitch intent, you know, intent on screaming into the microphone? so I, you know, I mean, you can have bad habits. You just have to know when to use them and how to deploy them. And I'm not saying I'm always successful with that, but you know, the fact is, if you've thought about what you're going to say, how you're going to say it, and who you're saying it to before you go on the air, you're going to get a lot more out of the time that you put into the podcast.
Thank you. Do you have a regular podcast that you can point us to that we can put on our website?
You know, I'm not doing one right now, but we're about to, Steve and I think are going to start doing some regular stuff. And then I'm also launching one for, my company, BuzzLogic, which, is a software company that I started a couple of years ago. And my co-founder and I are going to get on and talk about, the social media world and just sort of, the evolution of our business. We think it'll be interesting.
Well, please let us know. We will post that link in our show notes, or we'll just post it as one of our features or blogs when that goes live.
Great. Thanks.
When I was reviewing and evaluating the Podcasting Bible by Mac and Radcliffe from Wiley Publications, the words that I wrote down for my own notes, exceptional value, like I said, it's $35 U.S., $42 Canadian, £23 U.K. You must have $500 worth of value of information in this 500-page book. It's a serious book. It's deep. It's thorough. It's comprehensive. And my final notes are, it's a real class act. So congratulations, Mitch Radcliffe. I hope you sell 100 or 2 million books. And I hope the next time we talk, you've got a live podcast that you can tell us about. Thank you for joining us so much on the MyMac.com podcast, Book Bites Live.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.